Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Sunbury Press Books Show on the BookSpeak Network. I'm Lawrence Knorr, and I have with me none other than Mike Campbell. I will describe Mike as the world's expert on what happened to Amelia Earhart. And some might disagree with me on that, and some will agree with me on that, and I know Mike will agree with me on that. Mike is also the author of what I'll say is the book on the subject. If you want the truth, you got to go to Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last, now out in its second edition. We had done a first edition some years ago, and there was enough new information to do a second edition. That's been out for a little while. And the book has done very well for us and done very well for Mike. So welcome, Mike.
Hi, Larry. Good to be with you. Thanks for your kind words. Looking forward to discussing the situation, the Earhart situation, where a lot of people might believe that this is an old issue, a dead issue, an issue that doesn't really matter anymore. They couldn't be further from the truth. What's happening nowadays with the Earhart story is very, very exciting stuff, and we'll get to it soon.
Yeah, so let's take people back to 1937. So we're going back over 80 years, and I think I've told you this, but and I haven't proven this yet, but I have a special connection to this, possibly. I think Amelia might be a distant relative of mine. I had an Earhart as a great-great-grandmother, and I know that Amelia's relatives connected through this area in the past. And so I hope to find that connection someday. And I've always been interested in Amelia just because of that curiosity on my end, and never really thought as much about, you know, what actually happened and was there really mystery to it or some dispute to it, or you know, there's the given story and then there's the truth. So take us back to 37 and what you think happened, or what you say happened.
Well, Larry, this is very the first thing that your listeners should understand is that we can't even begin to get into any depth into anything in the time that we have. Everything that we're going to be talking about is like skimming the surface, the major points that people should mark down and keep in mind, and then everything that we're talking about is covered in detail in the book, Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last. Now, well, you're right. We have the official story about what happened to Amelia Earhart on July 2nd, 1937, and then we have the truth. And there's no relationship between the two. We are now in the 81st year of the Earhart cover-up, the government establishment media cover-up. They've all been working together for going on 81 years now to keep the truth from the American people. But the truth is hiding in plain sight. Anybody that wants to find it can go not only to my book, but to several other books too. I didn't make any of this up. Everything that I say in my book is footnoted and researched and documented, and my opinion you can hardly find my opinion in my book except a little bit in the introduction and at the conclusion. Otherwise, we just present facts. Okay? In 1937, on July 2nd, the great Amelia Earhart, who had already become the second person to ever solo the Atlantic Ocean in 1932. That was her huge achievement at the time. She had also, though, set many other international flight records. And her solo of the Atlantic, however, that's what really put her over the top and separated her from everyone else. Well, by 1937, she was ready to sort of retire, to do her to go off with George Putnam, her famous publisher husband, and enjoy life. She wanted to do one more thing, one more great flight, and that was the world flight. In 1937, she wanted to circumnavigate the globe at the equator or as close to the equator as she could, which would shatter Wiley Post's record of 1931, I believe, that he circumnavigated the equator at 15,000 miles. She wanted to do it at 27,000 miles, which is a much longer flight, a much tougher flight. And so that was the plan. She announced it in February. She took off in March from Hawaii, from Luke Field, and immediately crashed her airplane. It was the second leg of the flight. First, they took off. They started from Oakland, of course, and then they went to Miami or Hawaii, and she crashed on takeoff from Luke Field in Hawaii in March of 1937. They had to take the plane, ship it back to Burbank into the factory, redo the plane, repair the plane, extensive repairs. And then they started over. They started the flight over in the opposite direction. They went from Oakland down to toward Miami. That was the first phase. Then from Miami down into South America, and then crossed over there into Europe or into Africa, and then into Europe. It went pretty well up until July 2nd, 1937, when they wound up at Ley, New Guinea. Now, Ley, New Guinea was the key spot, the key takeoff point to Howland Island, which was the toughest leg of the flight, 2,556 miles of open ocean, never been done before the flight. Now, everything that I've told you so far and everything I've said has, and that anybody can find this in any book, you know, any biography, you know, this is all just background to locate the listener in, you know, in time and space. We don't want to waste too much time on this because these are prosaic facts that anybody can find. When Amelia left July 2nd, 1937 at 10 a.m. and took off from Ley with her navigator, Fred Noonan, who was the best in the world at the time, Fred Noonan, who also liked to drink, and some people like to blame the loss on him. That's just a bad rumor. He was fine. He was not drinking at the time of the flight. He was completely fresh during the takeoff. He was not hungover. He didn't drink the night before. All that's been proven to the best of our knowledge. So we can't blame Fred Noonan's drunkenness on her loss. Not a chance. The first part of the flight went well. She stayed in good radio contact with Ley, with the radio operator at Ley, and everything was going fine for about the first third of the flight. After about the first third of the flight, she signed off Ley, and she started to transmit toward Howland Island, her destination, and her ostensible destination, and the Itasca. The Coast Guard cutter Itasca was anchored at Howland Island for the express purpose of talking her in, helping her with direction finding, and to talk her into Howland, just a tiny speck in the Pacific Ocean. They had all the radio situation was good. They had the radio equipment they needed. Everything would have been fine, but nothing was fine. Nothing worked out. Communications-wise, it was a nightmare. She never stayed on the air longer than 10 seconds at a time, not even nearly enough for the Itasca to get any kind of a fix. They were talking on at cross lengths, cross purposes. They were not on the same schedule. There was misunderstandings. It's inexplainable. I can't really get into all the details about all the radio problems, but it was they never actually established two-way communication during the entire flight. In other words, she never said, "Hello, can you hear me?" They said, "Yes, we can," and she would say, "That's good." They never established two-way communications. However, they did get six or seven messages from her as she approached Howland. The last message that they received from Amelia came in at signal 505, signal strength. In those days, that's what they called it, strength 505. In other words, as strong as they could possibly expect it to be. And Leo Bellerts, the chief radio man on Itasca, actually expected he ran upstairs and actually expected to see her flying overhead. That's how close he thought she was. Of course, she wasn't close at all. radio signals can be deceptive. She wasn't anywhere near Howland Island, and that was. And her last message was heard at 08:44 a.m. Howland Island time. She said, "I'm on 157, 337." Line of position 157, 337. We're running north and south. Wait, listening on 6210. She didn't know it was going to be her last message. It actually sounded like she was trying to find Howland, but her verbiage didn't make any sense. For one thing, you can't run north and south at the same time. That doesn't make any sense. Nobody's ever been able to explain that to me. Okay, but after she left this last message with Itasca, she was never heard from again, officially. Never heard from again. No more radio transmissions. So the Navy goes out, and they send the Coast Guard, and everybody goes looking, okay? In total, they searched 262,000 square miles of the Pacific. Not even an oil slick was found. But, of course, they didn't search the Marshall Islands. The Marshall Islands were Japanese territory. We were not allowed to bring our Navy into the Marshall Islands to look for her. The Japanese said they would do that. Okay? It's been proven that the Japanese lied throughout the search about what they were doing and who was doing what. Japanese were lying to us throughout because they knew where she was, and they picked her up at Milly Atoll. Japanese picked her up at Milly Atoll in the Koshu, which is a Japanese survey ship that actually could actually put an airplane on its stern. It actually put the Electra on its stern and took the Electra to Saipan eventually. The flyers were taken from Milly Atoll to Jalawit, which was the Japanese headquarters in the Marshall Islands. At Jalawit, they were taken care of by a hospital corpsman named Bilamon Amaron, who was a Japanese-born hospital corpsman, not in the military. He was a civilian. He was 16 years old. He became one of probably the most important of the Marshall Islands witnesses later on. He saw Earhart and Noonan on the deck of the Koshu at Jalawit. He saw Noonan with a white bandage around his head. He treated Noonan's knee injury. He saw Earhart on the deck, identified her picture later, heard the crewman call the white woman on the deck, Melia, actually heard them call her that, okay? There's no question at all about Bilamon Amaron's credibility as an eyewitness. He became a very well-known entrepreneur in the Marshall Islands later on, very well-known and very beloved figure in the Marshalls. Many other witnesses in the Marshalls as well, okay? So from Jalawit, they were taken then from Jalawit to Kwajalein, which had an airstrip. We think that they were probably taken by ship to Kwajalein, although it's possible they were flown there, because Jalawit also had a seaplane base. Okay, the witnesses are very slim on that. From Kwajalein, however, we have many witnesses to her presence there, many, many, including GI witnesses that found her things in a room on Kwajalein that was dressed up for a woman. They found her diary, 10-year diary of Amelia Earhart, was found during the invasion of Kwajalein in 1944, January. From Kwajalein, she was flown to Saipan, okay? 1,500-mile flight, either seaplane or land-based plane took her to Saipan. Likely it was a seaplane, but we don't know for sure because native Saipanese who saw her land at Tanapag Harbor at Saipan in 1937, which was a strictly classified area on Saipan. The Japanese controlled Saipan at the time. They had been controlling it under the League of Nations mandate of 1920. But the Japanese were tyrannized the people of Saipan. They really treated them badly. They treated them like slaves. And so in 1937, the summertime, we don't know the exact date, but during the summer of 1937, we have the testimony of Josephine Blanco Akiyama, who was an 11-year-old Saipanese girl on Saipan taking her brother-in-law's lunch to him at Tanapag Harbor. It was a classified area, but he had a pass, and she had a pass to get in. She saw a plane, a silver plane, twin-engine plane, land in the harbor. She said it crash-landed, but she was 11 years old. She could have been confused. It might have been a seaplane. It might have been a land-based plane that was having trouble and had the belly land in the harbor. In either event, the Japanese picked them up from the harbor, brought them ashore at Tanapag Harbor, the flyers, the American flyers. And then from then, Josephine saw Amelia Earhart, later identified her picture, as did all the credible eyewitnesses on Saipan. Later picked her photo out of photo lineups of up to 10 photos, 6 to 10, whatever, how many photos Fred Gerner and other researchers presented with them to them. Josephine is still alive. She's 92 years old, I believe. She's living in San Mateo, California. Now, this all happened in July 1937. We didn't know anything about this. Nothing was known about this. The official word was put out from 1937 after the Navy search wound up in late July that they probably crashed 120 miles northwest of Howland Island, and that's most likely what happened, blah, blah, blah. That story has never been rescinded or officially changed, despite every piece of evidence in the world that it's hogwash, okay? Now, we skip ahead. Nothing happens between the war years, nothing that except a story or two that came out of the Marshall Islands that was mainly ignored. There was a few stories put out by a guy named Eugene Burns that was there for the invasion of Kwajalein, also put out stories about Earhart's things being found. But during the war years, these stories were just buried and they were just overshadowed by all events. But now we come up, you know, this is just a quick history, you know, and now we come up to 1960 when the real true modern search for Amelia Earhart began. And it began with Paul Breon Jr.'s book, Daughter of the Sky, that was published in 1960. Breon Jr. was a Air Force Academy English teacher. He was a lieutenant then, or something like this. He was a military man at the Air Force Academy, and I think eventually retired as a major. But Breon's book, Daughter of the Sky, began like a typical biography, a typical Earhart biography. On Amazon, if you go and you do a Google on Amelia Earhart, you'll find over 1,500 titles. 99.9% of those titles are biographies, novels, fantasies, everything that you could think of about Amelia Earhart except anything to do with her disappearance. There's only 10 books, approximately 10 books, that have been done that present any credible aspects of the truth about her disappearance. 10 out of all the books ever done. This in itself tells us how much this story, the truth about her disappearance and the truth about what happened to her is so despised and hated by our establishment that nobody will touch the story. It was left to only a few people. Fred Gerner was the only known quantity of a journalist that ever started or ever did this story after Breon. After Gerner's book, I'm really getting ahead of myself, though, here. Let's go back to Breon's book. You know, Breon's book, as I said, started out as a garden variety biography. However, at the end of the book, Breon became familiar with new information, was revealed to him by a guy named Casimir Schaft, who was a Navy dentist on Saipan in the late 1940s. Casimir Schaft's assistant as a dentist was Josephine Blanco Akiyama. Her name was Josephine Blanco then. Okay, later she got married, she became Akiyama. Now, and at that time, she was like 19 years old or something like this. And she told Casimir Schaft about what she saw at Tanapag Harbor in 1937. Casimir Schaft put this together, and he said, "Well, you saw Amelia Earhart." That's the only answer to this. Schaft got in touch with Paul Breon told him all about this, and Briand recorded Casimir Sheff's second-person account about Josephine at the end of his book, Daughter of the Sky. In other words, he didn't even interview her directly. He recorded it indirectly through Casimir Sheff. Okay? But people found out about it, obviously. One of the people that found out about it was a guy named Linwood Day, who worked for the San Mateo Times. Linwood Day found out about this through Briand's book. And he went and he interviewed Josephine because she lived in San Mateo. He did a whole series of stories about her beginning in May of 1960. May 23rd, 1960 was his first story. And so Fred Gerner, the local radio celebrity in San Francisco, saw these stories. And Fred Gerner became fascinated with this. He went and interviewed Josephine and her husband, and he was convinced that this was something very, very significant, very significant, very important. He got permission from CBS to go to Saipan. He went to Saipan in June of 1960 for the first of his four trips to Saipan, investigative forays to Saipan to interview potential eyewitnesses to the presence and death of Amelia Earhart in 1937. Gerner, on his initial visit, the first thing he did was to talk to the three missionary priests on Saipan, the three Catholic missionary priests on Saipan, to enlist their aid as translators, because the natives on Saipan could not speak English. They were Spanish-speaking. They were also almost 100%, if not 100% Catholic, and they all feared their priest, and he knew they wouldn't lie in his presence. So he made sure from the start that he was going to get straight stories from the potential witnesses. Gerner, this is one of the big lies that the establishment loves to tell about, if they even talk about it or approach the Saipan situation whatsoever, which they are loath to do. But they will, if they are forced, they will say, well, the Saipan natives just said what they were expected to say. They said what Gerner wanted to hear from them. That's another complete lie. Nothing could be further from the truth. Gerner didn't put words in anybody's mouth. Okay? So he interviewed 200 people approximately during his first trip to Saipan. Now, remember, Josephine was at Tanapag Harbor. That was a classified area. There are very few Saipanese were there to begin with. Okay? So very few people actually saw the white flyers at the time they came in. But later on, many more did see them, and many more heard about them. But Gerner did find what he called his original 13, his original 13 witnesses. These are people that if they weren't eyewitnesses, which there were about I'd say maybe 9 or 10 of them were eyewitnesses. The other ones were very close to being eyewitnesses. These were the credible witnesses that went into making up his original thesis, his original idea of what happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. And basically it was that they were picked up. Well, he didn't know of a Marshall Islands background, okay, at that time. In retrospect, in 1966, when his book was published, yes, then he could do that. But in 1960, when he was first doing his, he didn't know how they got to Saipan. He thought they might have even flown there. He didn't even know how ridiculous that idea was, okay? So, anyway, they were taken. Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan were taken by the Japanese. They were put into Noonan was taken to the Japanese military facility. They were both kept at Garapan Prison for a short time. Amelia was later taken to the Kobayashi Ryokan Hotel, where the Japanese kept their political enemies. Things, you know, this sort of a scenario. Eventually, more, you know, as Gerner accumulated more and more witness accounts and more evidence, he was able to put together a pretty good scenario that Amelia probably didn't live more than a year. She probably died from dysentery, although there are conflicting accounts. No eyewitness actually claimed to see her die from dysentery, but several were told directly by Japanese officers that she died from dysentery. Noonan, on the other hand, was most likely beheaded. Best evidence says that he was probably beheaded. He was not a happy guest of the Japanese on Saipan, not at all. He was also not shown any respect by them. whereas she was. They had never heard of a female flyer in their life. Of course, they knew Western news and all, but I mean, in the Japanese culture, a woman would never be a flyer. And so she got a certain amount of respect from them, according to certain witnesses. But that's basically, that's the beginning of the truth about what happened. And then after Gerner's book came out, where he presented all this incredible evidence, not incredible is not the right adjective. Amazing is better, because incredible means not believable. This is all very believable. And he really established the fact of their presence and death on Saipan in his book, The Search for Amelia Earhart, which was in 1966, which was the only bestseller ever written about the Earhart disappearance, 1966. He caught the government and the media complex establishment with their pants down a bit with this book, because they weren't really expecting it. They didn't really know what was going on until the book had already sold 400,000 copies. And then the cat was out of the bag at that point in 1966. And there was a lot of people in this country that were screaming at their congresspeople and other officials to get to the bottom of this obvious cover-up. What's going on? Why doesn't our government tell us the truth about what happened to Amelia Earhart, okay? Now, even Gerner was shown in 1963 by JFK's people, just before JFK was assassinated. He was actually shown some of the top secret Earhart files. He was with a guy named Ross Game, a California newspaper man, a very close friend of his. I actually talked to Ross Game a year before he died. Ross Game had ALS disease. I talked to him about 2005, and they were shown by Kennedy's people, top secret Earhart files. They were not allowed to copy them. They were not even allowed a pencil. They were shown the files because Kennedy wanted to help. He really wanted to help them. But according to Game, his hands were tied by a top secret executive order passed down by FDR that the truth about the Earhart disappearance will never be released to the American public. Okay, this is the root of the whole Earhart mystery, so-called mystery. This is the root of all of it. It all goes back to FDR and our government and FDR's order not to let the public know that he abandoned Earhart on Saipan during those early months after her disappearance. We knew they had her. We had the technology. We had broken their codes. We knew they had her within 2 weeks of her loss, and he was not ready to go to war over it. He was not ready to release the fact that we had broken the codes. He was not ready to release anything about it. Therefore, she was left out to dry on Saipan to the tender mercies of our Japanese friends, okay? This is the big secret. This is the root of all of it, and from this, we have the so-called Earhart mystery. There is no Earhart mystery. Okay, what we have is the truth that was originally released by Briand. Gerner greatly expanded on it, but in Gerner's book in 1966, he only presented about 5% of what we've learned since then. 5%. We've learned 95% more about the truth about her landing at Millie, her incarceration and death on Saipan. We've learned so much more. We have so many more documents. So much more has been done. So many more letters, witnesses, you name it, okay? But that's what it's all about. So there is no mystery. There is a so-called mystery. It's a complete cover-up. It's an 81-year cover-up. They call it a mystery. We have the truth, which I've been telling you. And then we have these theories. Everything is like, what's the theory? You know, this theory, that theory. All we hear about lately for the last 30 years is the Nicomororo hypothesis. This windblown, this very elite la-di-da idea, scientific methodologies and all this smoke and mirrors by these con men at Tigar about Earhart being landing at Nicomororo. This is all we ever hear, okay? It's all misdirection. It's a third-hand idea that was debunked and dismissed in the mid-'80s They didn't even make up this idea. Fred Hooven, the great inventor, had this theory. It was called the Gardner-McCain landing theory, and it was based on radio signals that were coming from all over the Pacific. And so in the late 70s, Fred Hooven was a friend of Fred Gerner. He developed this idea that they might have come down there at Nicomora or McCain Island. But then later on, they just dismissed it because there's no chance that they did. There's been a Loran Coast Guard station on Nicomora with dozens of Navy Coast Guard people that lived there that made all kind of garbage for 2 years during the war years. We have hundreds of Gilbertese that lived on Nicomora, made all kind of garbage. We had the SS Norwich, the British freighter that crashed on the reef there in 1929. 11 men died. They weren't all found. The bones that were found later were bones, obviously, from a Norwich crewman. I mean, it's not even a good lie. Anybody that looks into the Nicomora idea, this nonsense that we constantly get bombarded with, anybody that looks into it that has more than 3 IQ points to rub together will see what a fraud it is and how ridiculous it is. So, This is the best they can do to stay away from Saipan. They don't want to go anywhere near Saipan, and they know that the truth and the crashed and sank thing with them landing 120 miles to the northwest of Halland, that became such a joke after Gerner, especially after Gerner's book came out. The whole idea of that became so ridiculous they had to come up with this other thing. And this Nicomora thing is what the establishment came up with, and we've been stuck with that for 30 years.
Well, let me just interject here. So I know you mentioned Tiger, and I know we don't want to talk about them very much, but just for the listeners to understand, when you say Tiger, you're talking about the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, which sounds like an incredibly important group. This gentleman,
it's a clue into
but they don't have anything other than Earhart, right?
They've never recovered an aircraft. They've never done anything except perpetuate a con job on the American people.
Well,
that's what they do.
It seems like every time there's something in the news, these are the guys that are on the news. They find a little piece of aluminum somewhere, or they find a bone somewhere, or they talk about bones that were found some time ago, and these guys are involved, and it's never right. They never talk about Saipan, and it's just really
for 30
odd.
Years we've been
From
listening
my perspective,
to this for 30 years.
Yeah. As someone who's sort of on the outside of this, and I see these reports from time to time, and of course I know about your book and all the research you've done and these others who are helping to build this mountain of evidence, it sounds like you've got this mountain of evidence. While most of it is circumstantial, you don't actually have a body, you don't have the diary anymore, it was lost, but you have all these witnesses and secondhand stories and even military people, high-level military people on our side that had said things about this that support.
Exactly. We have
right.
You know,
so what do they
since
have?
We're talking
so
to
what
you,
do they actually have? Do they have lots of other eyewitnesses that counter
if they had the tiniest fraction of credible evidence that we do, the whole thing would have been case closed a long time ago, and we wouldn't be hearing anything else. There wouldn't be anything else happening. Okay, they have zero, zilch. Nothing has ever been connected to the Electra from Nicomora or the flyers because they were never there. Okay, it's impossible for them to connect anything. They just make this stuff up as they go along. It's absurd. It's just absurd. I've been living with this story for 30 years, ever since I met Thomas Devine, who was an eyewitness on Saipan to the Electra. He actually saw the Earhart plane on Electra 3 times in one day. He saw it destroyed. Other eyewitnesses who I've interviewed saw the Electra, saw it destroyed. The Electra was on Saipan, as we said, it was taken there by the Japanese. It was destroyed by order of FDR. We actually have a witness in the Oval Office who came forward much later to a friend of Thomas Devine in a phone call that said he was in the office when they announced to FDR that they had found Earhart's plane on Saipan in June of 1944 during the invasion of Saipan. Okay? It doesn't get any more incredible, I mean, remarkable than this. The evidence that we have, and we have one of the GIs named Robert E. Wallach, who became a very good friend of mine, during he was in the second wave in June of 1944 during the invasion. He was a Marine machine gunner, a corporal, and survived, obviously, survived the invasion, second wave. I mean, the invasion of Saipan was a bloody, bloody mess. It was one of the most bloodiest conflicts of the Pacific War. It was the key conflict of the Pacific War up till then. If we didn't take Saipan, we would not have won the Pacific War. We wouldn't have advanced to Okinawa and on to Japan. And Saipan had 30,000 Japanese in the garrison there defending that place. We brought everything we could against them, over 500 ships, about 100,000 men against Saipan, and we wiped them out. Wallach was there during the first, second wave of that. A couple weeks later, after the island had been secured, or right around that time, he doesn't know exactly the date, he found a safe. He was with some friends, found a safe in a Japanese administration building. They blew the safe open, and lo and behold, there's Amelia Earhart's briefcase with all her papers, her maps, her visas, everything else she needed to do her around-the-world flight. He finds her briefcase in a safe, and it was bone dry. Okay? So that's real evidence, I would say. And, of course, he couldn't keep it. He was just a lowly corporal. He was forced to turn it over to a Navy officer on Saipan, and it went down the rat hole, went down the black hole, and never to be seen again. And there were other things found, too, like many photos were found. Several photos were found by GIs on Japanese officers. Because even in those days, the Japanese loved to take photos. They were great photo takers. Yeah. So they took some photos of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan on Saipan. Okay? About six of those people reported seeing those photos. They were either the photos later disappeared or were taken or were destroyed or whatever. But I'll tell you, it doesn't matter. In the big picture, it really doesn't matter about the photos or about the briefcase, because we could have those things and they wouldn't matter. The establishment media would still be in lockstep with the establishment, and they would deny and ignore anything. We already have so much evidence that it's pathetic. And look at the way they play Tigar's tune when it's nothing. They have nothing, but yet they play that up as if it's something. And we have so much, enough to kill a horse, and we're ignored. Now, I mean, come on. I mean, this is, you know, this is Logic 101, junior high. You know, once you get into it and look at it, you know, anybody without an agenda can see what's going on. It's not rocket science, or else I wouldn't have been able to deal with it, okay? I couldn't even do trigonometry in high school. I was not good with that kind of stuff. But this is, you know, this is basic stuff. All you have to do is look at it and study it, and it just all jumps out. It all reveals itself to you. Plus, we have, and you talk about evidence, we have the O&I report. The Office of Naval Intelligence did a report in 1960 based on the fact that they knew what Gerner was doing in Saipan. Thomas Devine, who I just mentioned, had also come forward for the first time and talked to the Hartford, New Haven Register, I believe, or the Hartford Current, I think the Hartford Current, telling the newspaper about what he saw on Saipan. But he didn't tell them about the airplane. He told them he was shown the gravesite of the white flyers that came from the sky. That story made headlines in the East, in the Hartford, Connecticut area. The Office of Naval Intelligence found out about that. They interviewed Devine then. Devine told them about the gravesite that he was shown on Saipan in 1945. He was there on Saipan for a whole year after arriving in June, in July of 44, he was a postal sergeant. He was a postal officer on Saipan. He took care of the post office. Okay, so he wasn't there among the first waves to go on. He was an admin guy, you know. So, and he was also older. He was 28 at the time, and he was much more observant of things. And this is why Devine took all this back home with him, and eventually wrote one of the most important books of all time. I witnessed the Amelia Earhart incident, published in 1987, in which Devine presents his eyewitness accounts. However, he doesn't, at that time, he had not really come in contact with all the other GIs who knew about it. At the end of his book, he asked for everybody that knew about what happened at Aslido Field around the Electra being discovered in the hangar there in June of 44 to contact him, and they would, and then, you know, we would, they would establish the truth, and he issued a plea at the back of his book. Well, his book was greatly suppressed as well. However, in 1990, Divine was shown on Divine was allowed to tell some of his story on Unsolved Mysteries in 1990, and with Robert Stack, and so was Robert Wallach allowed to tell his story in 1990. Fred Gerner was also on that show briefly. Okay, that is the last time any mainstream show, with the exception of National Geographic, has gone anywhere near Saipan. 1990, Unsolved Mysteries. So Divine, I found out about Divine in 1988 when I was assigned to do a story. I read the books. This is one of the first ones that I read. I contacted Divine, and we stayed in touch. Divine shared all the information that he started getting from all these GIs, and 26 of them eventually contacted him with evidence, with their own accounts, own written accounts, and we presented those in our 2002 book, With Our Own Eyes. Okay? That was the first time that the GI accounts were actually publicly aired, all the different GIs that knew about the plane, that saw the plane, and other encounters they had with natives on Saipan that knew about the presence and death of Earhart and Noonan. The book was not very well done. It was my first effort, and it was pretty sketchy, and I wasn't really, you know, as smart about the story as I became within the next 10 years, and with you, and then in 2011, you of all people found with Truth at Last. You were the only decent publisher that was willing to stick your neck out for this book. They all ran away from it. The word had long been out that Saipan has to be avoided. The truth about Earhart, it's a sacred cow. This is one of our biggest sacred cows in Washington that there is. It's one of the oldest, if not the oldest as well. The Kennedy truth is also another sacred cow, for example. But I'm not going to get into any of the other ones, because all I'm doing is inviting, you know, people to call me a conspiracy theorist. This is what they love. This is what the establishment media loves to do with people that threaten their doxies. They love to call them conspiracy theorists. That is the words, those are the magic words that they brand people with to make sure that everybody else stays away from them and doesn't listen to them, because they are conspiracy theorists, the worst kind of nut. And I've been called that more times than I can count.
Well, I guess when you look at it objectively and you're seeing this pile of evidence, and then you see this group that's never found an airplane, but yet it's called the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. It can't find a damn airplane anywhere on the planet to recover. It keeps getting so much credibility, yet finds nothing and has no evidence. And to me, looking at it as more of an outsider, then I'm so glad we came across your manuscript and published your book. But when I look at this, it's like, why are they even talking to these people? So it's like either these guys are just really foolish, really off the mark, really unprofessional, just, you know, but even then they shouldn't be getting the attention. So when you see this, you have to think, why do they get so much attention? Why does the media even care about that? And why, with this mountain of evidence and these gentlemen,
especially
in the past,
after 30
also
years,
very credible, why are they ignored and discredited? And it's, and so let's
all
go
the
back
answers are
to,
in the book, Larry. All the answers, the answers motive. To those questions are all in the book, and everything is spelled out line by line. I couldn't,
yep.
I, you know,
yeah,
I can't do it on the.
I know we don't want to not sell any books, but. You know, just to summarize, I can see the need for FDR to preserve his reputation, and it's just amazing that to this day, between that and relations with our ally Japan and so on, that this.
Oh, that's a big. That's another one too. That's another aspect. There's no question that's a factor, but it's not the deciding factor, because if it was, then our Iris Chang would have also been ignored. Her book, The Rape of Nanking, would have been ignored by our establishment media, and it was not. It was a bestseller. And the Rape of Nanking pretty much exposed the Japanese for the butchers and the horrible barbarians they were in the pre-war years with what they did to 400,000 people at Nanking, China, okay? So, you know, we weren't trying to protect them with that book, with Iris Chang. In fact, Iris Chang became so traumatized after she published a book. The book became a bestseller in 1997. She became so traumatized and hounded by the Japanese that she eventually blew her brains out. She committed suicide.
Well, let's come.
That's how
relentless
they were.
Since your book, since the second edition was published, there's been some things that have happened. I know you're up to some things. We are about halfway through our show here tonight. We do have an extended show for this. I know that a little bit ago, I believe it was on the History Channel, there was a show and there was a photograph, and then there was all this controversy, and there was can you talk about that a little bit? What happened there? What was that all about?
Okay.
And was it the History Channel or was it National Geographic?
It was the History Channel.
I know, in just a few minutes. Yeah.
Well, I can't do it in a few minutes, but give me a few more minutes and we'll see. It's your listeners, any of your listeners that want to go and really get up to speed on what the History Channel did in July of last year with their a special was called Amelia Earhart, The Lost Evidence. This show was hyped by NBC on July 5th. The show was aired on July 9th. NBC opened the hype on July 5th by showing this photo. Your listeners can go, and I did many blogs on this, many articles. I had help from another very smart guy named Dave Martin, who understands how the establishment media works. And we just analyzed the whole thing, right down every hair of it. There's no question about what happened to this. I knew about this photo that was shown on July 5th of last summer. I had known about it for over a year. It had been discovered, I understand, in 2012 in the archives of National Archives in College Park, the Federal Archives in College Park. The photo was found in unclassified files, okay? Unclassified means anybody can look at it, anybody can get a copy, no big deal, okay? It was found by a researcher named Les Kenny, who I had worked with for a long time, who had known for many years before this. But with this photo, Les Kenny went off the deep end. He thought he saw things in this photo that were not in the photo. And this was in 2012. I didn't even learn about it, neither from him or anybody else, until I'd say let me think, about 2016 summer, somewhere in there, I heard news about this photo that Les had found, okay? And they had finally found somebody to do an Earhart special production around this photo. Now, the photo, it's an incredible photo. Anybody wants to come to the website, it's EarhartTruth.com. That's the name of my website, EarhartTruth.com. Two T's in the middle. They can see the photo. They can see the stories I did about it, et cetera. But the photo shows a group of people standing on a dock at Jellawit circa 1930s. We don't know when exactly it was taken. There's no date on the photo. There's only a numbered label on the bottom of it, and it says ONI, Office of Naval Intelligence, obviously. Somehow the photo came within the purview of the ONI, and it was found in unclassified files. The photo does not show Amelia Earhart. It does not show Fred Noonan. It does show a ship in the right background that is probably the Koshu. That's the claim, that it was the Koshu in the photo, and the Koshu was the ship that we know we picked up the flyers and put the Electra on its stern. Other than that, it's an interesting photo. However, it's not a smoking gun. It shows nothing but a blurry figure sitting on a dock who you can't even tell the gender of the person. You can't tell the sex of the person, whether it's a male or a female. You can't even see the face at all. It's all blurred, and they're claiming this was Amelia Earhart. They make this big fuss around this, and it was all planned. It was all, you know, it was all planned out and mapped out. It was a this whole thing was a disinformation exercise. What they did was they based the whole production around this photo. They pegged everything to the credibility of the photo and the validity of the photo. They also showed actual legitimate footage in the History Channel program that was legitimate. Of they actually showed some footage of Biddlemont Ameron. They actually showed Joaquina Cabrera, real eyewitnesses. They showed them speaking briefly. They showed other things that were legitimate, very briefly, all very fleeting, as if you know, these things were not important. But the photo on Jalowit is the main deal, okay? And it was the main deal for their purposes. Their purposes were to confuse the public, to make a lot of money, get ratings, and then 3 days, before 3 days had passed, even before the show had aired, even before July 9th, and the first news programs were, NBC was already announcing this and interviewing Kenny and Gary Tarpinian, the producer of Morningstar Productions, the ones that actually put this thing together for the History Channel. Even before July 9th, there were claims coming out. A Japanese blogger had found this photo before, that it was produced in 1935, already discrediting this. And then later that claim was discredited by the Marshall Islands. Official Marshall Islands release that said no, the photo was taken, could not have been taken in 1935 because the dock wasn't built until 1936. All this is completely confusing to the layman, does not know what to think, okay? And this is all preordained just to confuse. No media, after the airing of the History Channel, not one single media organization followed up on any of the Saipan claims, cared at all about those, because they were able to say that the picture had been discredited. Well, of course it had been discredited. There was nothing in it to begin with. Okay? The whole claim was phony from the start. The whole thing, they were just playing the American public for a few days to get ratings and money and to sow more confusion and more disinformation around the Earhart thing. Because anybody that wants to learn the truth about it can find it. It's a secret hiding in plain sight, as I said at the open. They could go to my book, Gerner's book, Devine's book, Vincent V. Loomis's book, and find aspects of the truth. But they can't find the truth in any greater amount or in any clearer version than they can in our book, Larry. Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last, brings everything together significant that's ever been done on the Earhart thing. We don't need the History Channel, you know, propaganda in there to poison anything. It's not necessary. Anybody that's interested.
Go ahead. Say, I've got your blood up a little bit to get it up a little more. Not that it's my intention, but the History Channel, though, I recall that you were hopeful that this was going to be hopefully a decent show on the topic. Didn't they reach out? Weren't they consulting you, or did they read the book or claim to be interested?
Yes, that's a good question. Yes, you're right. They led me along.
You saw what they were up to, and yeah.
They led me down the garden path for many months, almost a year. They told me they were going to have me on their program. They're going to come out to my house and film me. And they had no intention of putting me on their program. It was all just to find out, you know, what was what, to milk my brain and I don't know, just to generally. I don't know, to upset me or to get me wound up. I don't. But I spent over 6 hours with the writers and I spent over two hours with the chief of Morningstar, Gary Tarpinian, on the phone. He promised me that he would feature me as a credible expert, and yet they did none of it. And then at the end, when I realized, and then when I found out about the photo, and I saw that the photo was phony.
Yeah.
Then the cat was out of the bag then, before, you know, then I now understood.
Did you have any credits at all or any acknowledgement at all?
They thanked me
in
at the end. They had a special thank you at the end in the credits. That's all. as if I needed
it. Sort of like a little stab in the back.
Yeah. You know, and I said, as soon as I saw the photo and I understood, actually, I didn't see the photo until very late in the game, like maybe a week or so or 2 weeks. It's hard for me to remember, but I saw it before the NBC announcement for sure. And then as soon as they came out with the announcement, then I knew exactly what was going on. Up till then, I didn't know that they were going to base this thing almost solely on the photo. And then as soon as they did, I just jumped right on it. That same day, I produced a blog post that said, and the headline was something like, History Channel to feature bogus photo claim. You know, right from the start, I was on top of this. Nobody else is on top of this the way I was. Not even close. But we sold a lot of books during that period, as you'll recall.
Yes, we did.
They drove people. They drove people to my blog, into the book. It really did.
Now, recently, I mean, sales have picked up again, and I think we can touch on a couple more topics. Recently, there was this whole thing in social media and on the media about bones, and that the bones were found and that they were measured, and that, oh, my gosh, it's a Caucasian female of the right height. And how many other Caucasian females could there have been? You know, at that spot, it has to be her, and we're going to do, you know, so what can you say? I know I don't want to get you too worked up this late, but what can you share with
okay.
the listeners about that?
No, once
some
I get
of them
started,
may have
I don't
that.
Mind. No, Larry, once you got me talking, it's going to be hard for you to get rid of me now. Okay, we'll go the whole time, okay? This thing about the bones is not new at all. It's very old, okay? I'm looking at a 1998 UPI release about the same subject. And then, in those days, Rick Ross Gillespie, who was the chief of TIGAR, was claiming that the bones were not Earhart's, but they were Noonan's. And it says here, If the bones are Noonan's, where's Amelia, says Gillespie. He says if Earhart died on the island first, Noonan may have buried her, and her grave is still on the island, where they still hope to find her aircraft in the jungle someday. This goes back to 1998, okay? They just keep changing. It's like musical chairs. The story about the bones is ridiculous. The bones cannot possibly be analyzed by anyone because they disappeared in 1941. Dr. Hoodless, who was a Fijian or who had an office on Fiji, who was an anthropologist, analyzed the bones and called them the bones of a native down there, some sort of a Solomon Island or a Gilbert Island or a Gilbertese man who was over the age of 40 to 50 years old. That's the best that an expert examination could do in those days. Then the bones disappeared. Then here comes Tiger along. They take the paperwork from the only guy that ever actually analyzed the bones as an eyewitness to the bones. They say he didn't know enough, and modern technology is smarter than that. And so they changed all the findings and made it into a female that resembled Amelia Earhart. I mean, the absurdity and the lies, they never, ever end with these people. It's
right.
just
so,
absurd.
So they didn't
ridiculous.
Actually have the bones to look at and measure and analyze again. They were looking at the paperwork from way back in 41.
Yes.
They were just looking at the measurements and the results
Yes. And then they got a University of Tennessee professor, Richard Jantz, to go along with their false claims. I don't know where this guy got his PhD. Okay. It just goes to show PhD. I got to make up a new meaning for that acronym, because there's just too many people with that behind their name that are not credible people. I'm telling you, man. But this is the thing with the bones. It was a direct response to what's really going on. Now, you know, now we're in the home stretch of the program. Let's get to where the meat meets the rubber meets the road, my friend. What's really going on now is that on Saipan, where where our heroes met their ends, and shortly after 1930, their arrival there in 1937 on Saipan, there was huge news going on, absolutely gigantic news in the Earhart saga. Just recently, in early February, a committee has been formed on Saipan. It was announced in the newspapers. A committee was formed with the intent of building a memorial monument to Amelia Earhart at the Saipan International Airport. The money for the memorial can only come from private funds, private donors. No public funds will be used. The estimate for the memorial is $200,000, which to me seems like a very small amount. I have a photo of the artist's conception of what this thing is going to look like. It's on my blog. People can go there and look at it. It's just a beautiful thing that they have that this architect has come up with. The most important aspect of this monument, of course, is that it's a monument to Amelia Earhart on Saipan. Ironically, not only the island where she died, but practically the spot where her airplane was buried. The Electra was buried into rubble in late 1944, early 1945 or so, by the Americans. After it was burned and destroyed, it was buried into rubble with all the other metal that was found, all the other destroyed airplanes at Aslito Airfield on Saipan. The Earhart plane is under Saipan International Airport somewhere. We have no idea where, and we never will know where. It's in there with all the other metal. There's no possible way, okay? Not even GPR is only going to find metal. It's not going to identify an airplane, a specific airplane. So that's where the airplane is. And so that's something that only people that really pay good attention to the story really know and understand. What's important here is that the memorial get built, and the people of Saipan are 99-1 against the idea, I'm told, by smart people on the ground there. The woman who is behind this initiative, she's 84 years old. Her name is Marie Castro. She was 4 years old when Amelia was on Saipan in 1937. Later on, Marie interviewed, actually knew two key eyewitnesses. One of them she talked to at length on two different occasions. Her name was Matilda F. Ariola. She talked to Matilda twice. Matilda saw Amelia Earhart several times in the hotel, and next to the motel where they let her out a little bit, the Japanese. She talked to Matilda. She gave her daughter, Consolacion, a ring that got lost, another piece of evidence that got lost. Matilda was told, one of the key eyewitnesses that was told that Amelia died of dysentery. Marie Castro knew Matilda very well. She also knew Joaquina Cabrera. Joaquina was worked at the Kobayashi Ryokan Hotel on Saipan. She actually washed Amelia's clothes. She actually saw her leather jacket, took care of it, and washed it in a special way. She was also told that Amelia died of dysentery by the Japanese soldiers on Saipan. So Marie Castro is a direct link, and that is the title of my latest post, Marie Castro, An Iron Link to Saipan's Forgotten Past. She knew these people firsthand, okay? And she knew plenty of other people, too, indirect witnesses, secondhand witnesses. The people, the elders of Saipan, understand very well what happened. The only problem is there's very few of these elders left, and most of the island has been taken over by Chinese and Koreans, I'm told. It's become a tourist trap there. The youth there has been completely propagandized. They don't know anything about their history. They're all Facebook people, type people. They just hate being educated about what happened. And they don't even want to know. And plus, on top of all this, these people on Saipan, the Chamorros, they're not Americans. Okay, they're not even Caucasians. We have the racial element to go with it. And if you go to the Mariana Variety, which is one of the biggest newspaper on Saipan, is the Mariana Variety. And the editor there has been very good to me and allowed me to write as I wish to express myself and others about this issue. But they're running 99-1 against against the memorial. They don't want to know about it. They don't want her anything to do with her or anything else. So it's really, really bad politics going on Saipan, and it's really going to be a miracle, I think, if we get the money, and then even if we had the money to, so that this actually happens. There's one elected representative over there who's in favor of it, who's the president of the committee, the memorial committee. His name is Representative Donald Barcinis. He's an official elected guy. He's a Republican on Saipan. He's the key electorate guy. I don't know of one other elected official on Saipan that's in favor of this. All of them are against it, as far as I know. Okay, so this is a war. And the reason that it's a war, and the reason is obvious. If it gets built, if this memorial gets built, more and more people that pass through Saipan are going to see Amelia Earhart sitting there in all her glory and wonder, why is she here? What happened here on Saipan? The pressure is going to grow. More and more people are going to learn the truth about what happened to her, and more people in Washington are going to feel the heat. Okay, and they don't want that. That's the last thing they want. They don't want to have to deal with this sacred cow. They're perfectly happy with putting out Tygart disinformation on a regular basis. They don't want to have to try to explain Saipan. That's a little bit different kettle of fish, just a bit. Okay, so Marie Castro approached me and asked me to be the U.S. representative in the United States on the committee. I was honored and glad to do it. But I'm not a fundraiser. I'm not trained to be a fundraiser. I mean, and it's no fun, you know, asking people for money. And then and you really find out who your friends are, too, because people hate this story. As I said before, this story is hated, and nobody wants to stand up. Very few do. You're one of them. Very few people want to stand up for the truth. It's too easy to go with the mob, too easy to go with the crowd, with the Earhart thing. You know, so here we are. And I don't know if this memorial is going to happen or not. If I had to bet either way, I would bet no.
That would be too bad.
Yeah, it would.
Well.
It would, because it.
I was going to say we got a few minutes to go, maybe 15. What are you up to these days? Besides this memorial, is there some other things you're focused on? What's up with Mike?
There's nothing else I'm focused on. This is my life. The Earhart, this is my life. This is what I'm focused on. I go to the gym, you know. I try to stay in shape. I cut my grass. I try to stay on the right side of things. I go to church. I mean, all those boring, prosaic things. Yes, yes. Once in a while, I get to do a presentation. I'm going to the Ponte Vedra Library next week to do a presentation. I have a PowerPoint presentation that I do. I can tailor it to any length, but anything less than an hour is just a waste of time. I developed this PowerPoint presentation for the 99s, which is the worldwide female aviators club. Only female pilots can join, and Amelia Earhart herself began the 99s in 1929 with Louise Thaden. The two of them began that club. And in 2014, I was invited to present to the 99s in Wichita. They were having a meeting of several groups of the 99s, South Central biannual meeting. And so I developed this PowerPoint presentation. I went 2 hours with it before they had to stop me.
Wow.
So I do that whenever I can, but there's so little interest in this in reality, Larry. The interest that you see, I mean, that you might perceive, or the layman perceives out there when he sees the internet, or he goes on Fox News, for example. Well, you know, they're one of the leading water carriers for Tygar. They won't even allow my name on the comments section of their website. They will not allow the name of my book, of our book, to be on the comments section of their website. Neither will anybody else that I know of. But Fox is the worst. They're the ones that really irritate me because they claim to be so fair. They're just as bad as everybody else when it comes to the Earhart problem. Just as bad, okay? You know, so people don't know. If you look and you seek, you will find. But if you don't, you won't find. And you won't be directed by the media at all to anything. The only place you'll be directed is to this nonsense coming out from Tygar at all times. It's so frustrating. this work is just so infuriating.
Yeah, it seems to have a pulse to it, like every so many months, maybe it's once a year. I don't know if it's every anniversary. I haven't really looked at the time. You're probably much more aware of their activity.
There is a pulse to it. Yes, there is. Yes, there has been. Every other year, TIGAR has gone back every other year since 1989, they've gone back to the island with boatloads of money. They're a nonprofit organization, which means they all get nice, fat salaries, and they get this money, I believe, through black ops, through government black ops. Nobody in their right mind would give these people a dime. I don't believe that they're actual real private citizens that are giving TIGAR money. I know from personal experience how hard it is to get anybody interested or even to sell a book about the Earhart disappearance, as good as our book is, it's all relatively speaking, nobody cares about this, okay? I know this from firsthand experience, very, very few. And most of the people that do care are very old. They're old, they remember sitting in front of the radio with their families. They remember this being the biggest news in the world in 1937. There was no TV, no internet, just radios and newspapers. And her loss was huge. It was the only thing going on.
Yeah. Well, I guess we can look at it too, like maybe Tiger is doing us a favor by keeping a pulse on this so that we can keep talking about how they're wrong.
Well, yeah. I mean, if there was...
I'm trying to put a positive spin on it, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose, because there's no way they're going to talk about the truth, the media. They're never going to do that. The only way that this is ever going to break, the only way the truth will actually ever be known and accepted is full government disclosure. The U.S. government will have to step forward and say, this is the truth. We've been hiding it all this time. Full disclosure. That's the only possible way. There's no other way. We could find video, film. We could find film of her being beheaded on Saipan. That would also be suppressed and ignored. There's only one way. That's it. Very few people understand that concept. They think that once the evidence is there, then it can't be denied. Oh, yes, it can be denied. It's been denied ever since 1966. And Time Magazine, Fred Gerner's book proved it to most people's satisfaction. It certainly made a strong case. Okay, and at that time, Time Magazine came out, the official news voice of the USA. Time Magazine in 1966. Sinister Conspiracy was the name of their review. Don't go here, sheeple. Nothing to see. This is all nonsense. Don't waste your time with this book. And ever since Time said Sinister Conspiracy, don't go here, Saipan and Earhart has been in the media verboten, basically verboten. Don't mention it. Don't go in there. Don't go there. Unless you're a conspiracy theorist.
Where do you think the bones are?
We think the bones, if they weren't cremated, there is a strong possibility they were cremated. The Japanese cremated people that died of dysentery. That was a well-known fact in those days. They cremated just about everybody on Saipan that died, but especially dysentery victims. They were very fastidious about their germs, okay? They didn't like dysentery germs hanging around. So Matilda was told she was cremated. Joaquina was told that too, I believe, and so were some other people. Some other people were told they were buried. We're not sure, okay? In 1944, during the invasion, a Marine intelligence officer named Tracy Griswold took two privates, Edward Henson Burks and Billy Edward Henson Jr. and Billy Burks, took them to a site right outside the Liang Cemetery in South Garapan, outside the city limits of Garapan, took them to a site. They dug there. They removed two sets of skeletal remains, completely skeletal remains. When they were done, Henson asked Griswold, what did you bring us here for, and what was this all about? And Griswold made the only mistake that he made. He said, have you ever heard of Amelia Earhart? He said, he swore them to secrecy on the spot. He said, never say a word about this. He took the bones, put them in a canister, and off he went. They never saw him again. until he was, they were shown his photo separately in lineups in 1964, 1965, after they had contacted, after Henson had contacted Ross Game in California, because he heard about Gerner's work, he heard about the work of Linwood Day, and so he wanted to come forward with a story about finding the remains. Now, if those remains were of Earhart and Noonan, your guess is as good as mine where they are. They could have been secretly buried in a private place. They could have been, they could be hidden away in some national government archive now. They could be, who knows where they could be. But wherever they are, very few know where. Very few know where they are. That evidence, and the same thing with the evidence. Maybe the evidence was destroyed. Maybe the briefcase was burned up. Maybe the photos were burned up. Maybe the other thing, what was that? The diary was burned. The diary was found. Now, recently, we've heard that Matilda was told that she found a book titled Aviator, and it's a book that any pilot would use to keep log numbers and to keep their logs and things in. That's recently revealed, making Matilda's story even more credible than it already was. Okay?
Sure.
Who knows, Larry? We just don't know what happened to the bones, you know.
It's just interesting that some of these episodes happened and some of this evidence seemed to have been discovered and collected and disappeared, and now makes you think there's a crate somewhere in an archive in a back room in a basement. And
It's possible, but it's not a back room in a basement. It's a very special place, and only a very few people know about its existence in our deep state. Okay, there are people that are assigned to this story. You can believe that. The fact that this old, washed out, worn out, discredited story from Tigar was suddenly released across all the whole internet, every news organization you could probably you've ever heard of released this old, stupid, discredited disinformation story on the heels of the Saipan committee's formation in early February is not an accident, okay? There's a monkey in Washington that's in charge of this story, and they push the buttons, okay, and the media jumps. I've learned this the hard way. I've learned this. There's no other way. There's no denying it. It's a real active thing that's ongoing.
Who is this Gillespie guy really? What was his background? Why would he be the guy?
I don't know. I'm not interested enough in his. I think I heard that he sold insurance or something before this, or some sort of insurance investigator, something like this. That's all I know. I don't care. I don't need to know. I don't want to know his background. All I know is what he's responsible for. And no one has done more damage to the truth in the last 30 years than Tigar, and Gillespie is the head guy, and he's got henchmen around him, and they also help. Nobody's done more damage. Nobody has confused the public more than these people.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm just curious why on earth they have so much credibility that the media, anytime they come out with something, it's right there. It's broadcast everywhere. It's on the news.
It's synthetic.
It's amazing how much attention
synthetic.
They get.
They get attention, but it's synthetic. It's not real. And they don't have credibility with anybody that they can read. It's all show. It's all just a smoke and mirrors. Nobody that I know gives them any credibility. They ran out of credibility a long time ago. But yet the layman would think that they have credibility because the layman doesn't know any different. He just doesn't know any different, and he doesn't really care that much. You know, this is not a burning issue. It hasn't been a burning issue since. Probably since Gerner's book in 66 has it really turned on the American public to any degree. And it's been fading ever since. You know, I'm a lone voice out here, Larry. I'm just about the lone voice. I'm in the direct line of Gerner. Devine worked with Gerner. Devine, a new Gerner, and Lance Gerner, Fred Gerner's son, has contacted me. We've had many long conversations. I'm really the last of the Mohicans here with the torch. There's nobody else doing this work, Larry. Nobody. And in our book, And during the summer, our book became not only the number one disappearance book, our book became the number one of all Earhart books. Now, almost as soon as our book was published in 2012, the first edition, our book soon became the number one disappearance book of all the disappearance books. But it took time for it to climb to where it's the number one of all the books, because most of the Earhart books are children's books. They sell very well, all these children's books about her biography, you know. And so that's where we get all the competition. But we've even outstripped them since July. Now, we've been going down since then. I mean, we're not always the number one of all the books, but sometimes we are, sometimes we're not. But as far as the disappearance goes, there's never been anybody that comes close to this book in treating with the disappearance. Gillespie has a book. Gillespie's book is called Finding Amelia. A book has never been more misnamed than Gillespie's book. It came out in 2003, I believe, and it's called Finding Amelia. And it's not even about his phony claims. His book is about the search, the Navy and Coast Guard search. And he only uses about 2 pages of the whole book to talk about Nicomoraro. Because he knows what BS it is. He knew that the book was put out by the Naval Institute Proceedings. So the book is basically an honest book about the search, the Navy and Marine and Coast Guard search for Amelia. It's called Finding Amelia, but it's considered a disappearance book, loosely considered. That's the only book that ever came near us as far as popularity. They now have 69 reviews on Amazon. We have 130. And we're not finished getting more. We're going to get more, a lot more than 130 before we're done. I promise you. The more people find out about it, the more people are going to get it.
Well, Mike, I know that even though it seems like people don't care about it enough, the book does continue to sell steadily. And it seems like every time there's one of these bizarre news accounts from the other side, the truth at last sells. And
anyway, and it drives people.
Been a pleasure. Been a pleasure talking to you and just discussing this subject with our listeners. And sorry to get your blood up there in the middle as much as I did.
No, it's fine. No, really, Larry. That's the only way. You know, I live with this story day in and day out. This is what animates me, and this is a worthy cause, okay? And I want to remind your listeners, please go to my blog, EarhartTruth.com. You'll see all the information about the Saipan Initiative. Please look at it, consider it, and please consider sending them any kind of a donation. It's all private funds that are going to make this thing happen, and only private funds. Please consider this. It's worthwhile. It's a very worthy cause.
All right, Mike. Well, thank you for joining us. It was a pleasure having you.
Pleasure
being
with you,
everybody
Larry.
Else. Everybody else, thank you for listening to the Sunbury Press Book Show. I'm Lawrence Knorr. Please join us next time.